Stokowski claims Sir Charles Hubert Parry is one of his composition teachers. Parry stopped teaching 2 years before Stokowski entered the school in question. One of the many marvelous tales told by the maestro explains how he got his first violin. I know how old I was because one night a man walked into that Polish club with a little something in his hand. I said to my father, "What's that?" He said, "It's a violin." And I said to my grandfather, "I want a violin." He did buy me, what's it called? A quarter-size violin. And so I began at the age of 7 playing the violin. And that is still my favorite instrument. The first problem we encounter here is that his grandfather had died 3 years before Leopold was born. Secondly, his brother wrote, Leo never went to Pomerania or Lublin, where the event supposedly took place, or anywhere else out of England until he was of age. He did not learn the violin when young, and not at all, as far as I know. Though Stokowski's story of playing the violin reappears, and he listed the violin as his instrument when joining the Musicians' Union in 1909, his biographer, Oliver Daniel, says he never encountered a single person who ever saw Stokowski play a violin. Recollections, suppressions, confabulations. Stokowski was called an enigma and misterioso, despite his extravagant display of himself all through life. His own reasoning seems clear. I think that one should cultivate memory. I think that one should also cultivate forgetfulness. Stokowski's entire life required a counterlife, Philip Roth's term, the creation of a fantasy biography. Stokowski lived actively into his 96th year. In his last days, he burned most of the letters he had received from the great people, like Stravinsky. He didn't want any record of himself. Except, of course, the extraordinary recordings of his conducting, which he was making until his death. This pattern that Stokowski fought so hard to preserve, inventing his origins, disguising his youth, falsifying dates, losing his memories, the gods themselves seemed to favor and even continue. For after his death in England, paintings of Stokey, many drawings and paintings that Stokowski himself had done, notebooks, talismans, mementos, and many personal items that he had acquired during his long life were loaded into a huge container and sent to America. During a severe Atlantic storm, the container was washed overboard. The intense resistance to biography has been described by Michael Holroyd, a biographer of, among others, George Bernard Shaw. He draws a distinction between life and work and succinctly expresses the popular feeling. Whenever any man of imagination is made the subject of biography, his light may be extinguished. For, the argument goes, life is simply a shell, the kernel of which is creative work. The biographer has the Midas touch, but in reverse, each piece of gold he touches turns to dross. If you value your work, you must not let a biographer near you. That's the popular feeling. Holroyd defends the biographer's trade against the anti-biographical tirade, but he stops short. He neglects the emotional truth of the anti-biographer's view. He seems to miss the archetypal conflict between work and life, and the archetypal necessity of concealment. For it is the genius who is the anti-biographical factor, the genius who may be offended by life on earth, even though all its efforts seem expanded down to touch earth and expanded out to reach widely into the world. Still, it never quite humanizes. The enemies of the biographer are not only the subject and the family of the subject, the loyal friends with their private caches of letters and memories, the anal archivist, the sealed-away documents like state secrets. The genius, too, is the enemy of rational accounts that ipso facto explain it away. The great disguiser is the daimon. Somehow, the descendants of the eminent continue to feel its hovering presence, monitoring their protectionism years after the person in question has given up the ghost. Writing biography becomes another impossible profession, Janet Malcolm's characterization of psychoanalysis. impossible because the person whom biography purports to be about is not altogether a person, as the case an analyst works with is the invisible psyche brought in by a person. Biographers are ghostwriters, even ghost busters, trying to seize the invisible ghosts in the visibilities of a life. A biography that sticks to the facts as closely as it can finds ever clearer traces of the invisible, those symptoms, serendipities, and intrusive inventions that have led or pursued the life the biography recounts. Jung tried to make this apparent by presenting two personalities as the subjects of his autobiography. Like an old Eskimo, he included the dream soul even in its title. A recent thinker about biography states that biography has never really had a generally accepted terminology and protocol, a poetics that could be upheld and resisted. This uncertainty about what it is doing comes with the duplicity of the territory, and disillusionment is the biographer's best reward, not the biographer's disillusionment with his or her subject. That disillusionment so often expressed in fits of pique over dishonesties and concealments. Rather, a bracing disillusion with the world of straight fact. A disillusion that can convert the biographer to a more happy illusion, the reality of the daimon who prompts the life and the work, his or hers, too. This would then be the acorn theory's contribution to biographical theory. The relative weight of work and life, genius and person, haunts one's life with the feeling of never being able to size oneself up. There is a constant play between importance and humility, reflected in those states called mania and depression. Galleries hold retrospectives. Academies stage award ceremonies, offer testimonials, grant honorary degrees. Critics estimate and evaluate, attempting to strike the right balance. This uncertainty about size is formulated by the Bella Coola people who say the soul image is small but of great power. The heart soul is likened to a kernel of corn by the San Juan people. The smallness of the kernel and the kernel's power are both felt by the subject, and they appear also as one of the major conflicts in biographers, who inflate their subjects and detract from them at the same time, filling in the genius with human shadow. One biography of D.H. Lawrence is called Portrait of a Genius, But what draws biographers to write in the first place, and us to read? The wish to catch sight of the genius, not Mr. Gillespie and Mr. Waller, but Dizzy and Fats. When the daimon speaks, it says, "The stories I tell about tinkering with watches, Ford, or about rising from poverty all on my own, Bernstein, are the facts. The fables I tell more truly tell who I am. I am telling the story that gives backing to what has happened. I am reading life backward. I am telling the story of genius, not of little Lyndon, little Lenny, little Leopold. They are the figures whose image in the heart forced them forward, distorting their childhoods from the usual. And so I must tell the story of distortions to really tell the truth." The story must be adequate to the exceptionality of the genius. The ordinary lot of suburban Jewish meals, Lenny B., of haying on father's farm, Henry E., of hill country squabbles and prayers, Lyndon J., are simply not adequate, and probably cause the angel great discomfort. Stokowski was protecting his angel all through his life, preventing it from being written into the wrong tale, which might have killed it. And Freud, at 29, before he had made a single mark or hit upon a single one of his lasting ideas, already knew the art of disguise. What prompted that protective, destructive fire but prescience of what was to come? To protect the genius, we must protect the story in which the genius can live. Else it might take its invisibility literally, grow silent, and disappear for fear of being reduced to mediocrity. We need this same imagination which seeks the small kernel, when we are annoyed by the confabulations of later childhood and adolescence. The disguises and boastings are not mere cover-ups, daydreams, and grandiose fantasies. They are fears of loss, fears of colonization, fears of slavery to a normalizing system that, by capturing my image in biography, my takeover and walk away with my soul. Of course the biographer must pry and peep, since what is searched for is the invisible. But it is invisible not because of my concealment, but because of the archetypal nature of the kernel itself. Nature loves to hide, said Heraclitus. The acorn of a human nature does too. It hides all through the visible, displaying itself in the very disguises in which it hides. Biographers get to the invisible by sorting through the disguises, but only if the eye that seeks is intent upon the invisible, bringing to its task the same love that nature has for hiding. Maybe it takes genius to see genius. Chapter 9. Fate. Fate and Fatalism. But if the soul chooses its daimon and chooses its life, how have we still any power of decision? Asks Plotinus. Where is our freedom? All that we live and believe to be ours, all our arduously arrived at decisions, must in truth be predetermined. We are snared in a delusional veil, believing that we are the agents of our own lives, while all along each life has been laid down in the acorn, and we are but fulfilling a secret plan in the heart. Our freedom, it seems, consists only in opting for what the acorn intends. To cast off this erroneous conclusion, let's make clear what the genius does and does not do. Let's become more precise about the range of the acorn's powers. In what ways is it effective? And how is it limited? If it causes behaviors in childhood, what do we mean by cause? If it intends a specific way of life, such as theatrical performance, mathematical invention, or public politics, what do we mean by intention? Has it a final end in view, even an image of fulfillment and a date of death? If it is so powerful as to fatefully determine school expulsion and childhood illnesses, what do we mean by determinism? And finally, if it is the acorn that gives the feeling that things could not be otherwise, that even the wrongs have been necessary, what do we mean by necessity? Answers to these questions are at the heart of this book, for if these concerns are not laid out clearly and dealt with, we are likely either to abandon ourselves to fatalism or to abandon the book to fantasy. Fatalism is the seductive other side to the heroic ego, which shoulders so much in a do-it-yourself, winner-take-all civilization. The bigger the load, the more you want to put it down or pass it off to a larger, stronger carrier like fate. The hero is America personified. The heroic ego landed on Plymouth Rock, went with Daniel Boone into the wilds with gun, Bible, and dog, stands tall in Tombstone with John Wayne, and stonewalls his corporation against the whole bloody planet. This ego cut its way through the forest and made its own path despite competitors and predators. Even she, Little Red Riding Hood, has to cope with harassment by the predator wolf on her lonely path. This burden of being alone with your own self-made destiny in a world lurking with figures that want to do you in makes life one hell of a struggle. If I do not beat back the obstacles and push my way forward, I could be left back in school, or become an underachiever and sent for counseling to get me through psychological blocks and fixations. I have to advance from preschool onward. I have to develop, climb, defend, secure simply to exist, for that is the heroic definition of existence. Not much fun here. And when Little Red Riding Hood does pause to pick flowers to put in her generous basket of goodies for grandmother, up pops the toothy wolf. In this paranoid definition of life, life as struggle, competition for survival, the other as either ally or enemy, fatalism offers surcease. It's all in the stars. There is a divine plan. Whatever happens, happens for the best in the best of possible worlds. Voltaire's Candide. The world is off my shoulders, for it is really carried by fate, and I am really in the lap of the gods. Just as Plato's myth says, I am living the particular fate that has come straight from the lap of necessity. So it doesn't matter what I choose. I'm not really choosing anyway. Choice is a delusion. Life is all predetermined. This way of thinking is fatalism, and it is not what is meant by fate. This way of thinking reflects a belief system, a fatalistic ideology, not the goddesses Moirai, whom we call in English the Fates, and who appear in Plato's myth arranging the lots and leading the daimon toward our birth. They do not predetermine each and every event as if life were set up by them. Rather, the Greek idea of fate would be more like this. Events happen to people. They cannot understand why it happened, but since it has happened, evidently it had to be. Post hoc ergo propter hoc. After the event, post hoc, we give an account of what made it happen. Ergo propter hoc. It is not written in the stars that the stock market must crash in October 1987, but after it has crashed, we find reasons that clearly made it necessary for it to have crashed right then. For the Greeks, the cause of these untoward events would be fate, but fate causes only events that are unusual, that oddly don't fit in. Not each and everything is laid out in a superior divine plan. That sort of comprehensive explanation is fatalism, which makes for paranoia, occultist Ouija board prognostics, and passive-aggressive behavior combining meek submission to fate with bitter anger against it. So it is better to imagine fate as a momentary, intervening variable. The Germans use the term Augenblicksgott for a minor divinity that passes in the blink of an eye and has a momentary effect. The religious might speak of an intercessionary angel. Rather than a constant companion who walks with you and talks with you and holds your hand through all the crises of the day, fate intervenes at odd and unexpected junctions, gives a sly wink or big shove. You sell your shares after studying the market. The very next day, a corporate takeover is announced, and what you sold goes up 30%. Just at the finish line, the wind dies down, and the rival boat glides past to win by 1 second. But if you get out of the market altogether and stuff your gold in your mattress because it is not your fate to invest, or if you decide you were not meant to win the sailing cup, perhaps not meant to win at all or even to sail, and that the sudden dying wind is an omen indicating that you are out of touch with the elements, and so you sell your boat and shift your sport to rock climbing or lapse into melancholy, these are your choices, resulting from the meaning you find in the wind. To see the hand of fate in these untoward events raises their importance and gives pause for reflection. To believe, however, that your market timing and the 1 second loss are deciding your life for you, this is fatalism. Fatalism would give all over to fate. No need to vote, no need to fight for gun control or join mothers against drunk driving. No need even to have a fire department, since shit happens, and it's all meant to fall just as it falls. Cast the I Ching. The little sticks will tell you what fate wants you to do. That's fatalism. Catching the sly winks of fate is a reflective act. It is an act of thought. While fatalism is a state of feeling, abandoning thoughtfulness, specific details, and careful reasoning. Instead of thinking things through, you give up to the larger mood of fatality. Fatalism accounts for life as a whole. Whatever happens can be fit within the large generality of individuation, or my journey, or growth. Fatalism comforts, for it raises no questions. There's no need to examine just how events fit in. The Greek word for fate, moira, means a share, a portion. As fate has only a portion in what happens, so the daimon, the personal, internalized aspect of Moira, has only a portion in our lives, calling them but not owning them. Moira derives from the root S-M-E-R, or M-E-R, meaning to ponder, to think, meditate, consider, care. It is a deeply psychological term, requiring us to scrutinize events with respect to the portion that comes from elsewhere and is unaccountable, and the portion that belongs to me, what I did, could have done, can do. Moira is not in my hands, but Moira is only a portion. I can't abandon my actions or my abilities and their realization, and their frustrations and failures, to them, the gods and goddesses, or to the will of the daimonic acorn. Fate does not relieve me of responsibility. In fact, it calls for more. Particularly, it calls for the responsibility of analysis. By analysis, I do not mean a reductive psychoanalysis. I do not mean pinning blame on a cause, saying, the daimon made it happen. It's my fate. I can't help making mistakes in the stock market. I was never taught by my father. My mother spent money like water. As a child, I never had an allowance, and so never learned to manage money. I am self-destructive. And so on and so forth. Pinning blame on a chain of causes, leading back to the parental fallacy. When the Greeks analyzed an untoward and obscure event, they went to the oracle to ask which god or goddess they should sacrifice regarding this trouble, this desire, this piece of business. First, to become more specific. Second, to propitiate more accurately. Analysis in this model tries to discover which fate, which archetypal hand asks to be noticed and remembered. We remember fate's portion when adding Deo concedente, or God willing, as the Irish put it, after any little plan, such as one to take the train tomorrow. I'll see you at the station then, God willing. I intend to go there. I will make arrangements. But the untoward can happen. So I remember the fate's portion with Deo concedente. Or I touch wood. Pious old Jews hardly said a sentence without invoking the possibility that something untoward can intervene and counter their intentions. This recollection, by touching wood, of the unpredictable interventions of fate brings us back to the daimon. For the daimon surprises. It crosses my intentions with its interventions, sometimes with a little twinge of hesitation, sometimes with a quick crush on someone or something. These surprises feel small and irrational. You can brush them aside, yet they also convey a sense of importance, which can make you say afterward, fate. Telos and teleology. Fatalism bestows a feeling that what happens in my life is intended toward a distant, misty goal. Something is meant for me. I am meant to be a singer or a bullfighter. I am meant to have success, or be cursed and wronged and luckless, or to die in a certain way on a certain day. The image I am born with not only pushes from the beginning, it also pulls toward an end. Teleology is the term for this belief that events are pulled by a purpose toward a definite end. Telos means aim, end, or fulfillment. A telos is opposite to cause, as we generally think of causes today. Causality asks, who started it? It imagines events pushed from behind by the past. Teleology asks, what's the point? What's the purpose? It conceives events aimed toward a goal. Finalism, another term for teleology, maintains that each of us, like the cosmos itself, is moving toward a final goal. The goal may be defined in a variety of ways: reunion with God and redemption of all sins, slow entropy running down to stasis, ever-evolving consciousness and the dissolution of matter into spirit, a better life or worse, apocalyptic catastrophe or divine salvation. Teleology gives a logic to life. It provides a rational account of life's long-range purpose, and teleology reads whatever happens in life as confirming this long-range vision. For instance, God's will, his divine plan. If we drop the ology and just stick with telos, we can get back to its first and original meaning, formulated by Aristotle. That for the sake of which. I go to the store to buy bread and milk, not because I was pulled by a vision of the betterment of mankind, not because of a defined philosophy that governs all actions, including why I married and had children and lease a car so I can get to the store for their needs, all of which can answer any question why with one final teleological answer. Telos gives a limited, specific reason for the sake of which I perform the action. It imagines every action to be purposeful, but it does not state an overriding purpose to action in general. That would be teleology, or final ism. For Telos, it's enough to say I went to the store for the sake of the family breakfast. We are spared the philosophies of breakfast, the theology of caring, the symbolism of the morning meal, the morality of duty, the pseudo-politics of family values, the psychology of needs and wants, the economics of nutritional costs, the physiology of morning metabolism. There are many philosophies of breakfast that can satisfy your teleological vision of life. Many gods come to the breakfast table. But the telos, the purpose of the bread and milk and run to the store, is simply the breakfast itself. Eat first, talk later. The acorn seems to follow just this sort of limited pattern. It does not indulge in long-term philosophies. It disturbs the heart. It bursts out in a temper, as it did in Menuhin. It excites, calls, demands, but rarely does it offer a grand purpose. The pull of purpose comes with force. You may feel full of purpose, but just what it is and how to get there remains undetermined. The telos may even be double or triple, and confused about whether to sing or dance, write or paint. Purpose does not usually appear as a clearly framed goal, but more likely as a troubling, unclear urge coupled with a sense of indubitable importance. Two stories from the childhood of the Swedish filmmaker and theater director Ingmar Bergman will bring out the indeterminate determinism of the acorn. As a small boy, Bergman says, he was prone to lying and often unable to distinguish between fantasy and reality, or as he puts it, between magic and oatmeal porridge. At the age of 7, he was taken to the circus, an event that drove me into a state of feverish excitement. The crucial moment came when he saw a young woman dressed in white, riding around on a huge black stallion. I was overcome with love for this young woman. She was included in my fantasy games, and I called her Esmeralda. Under an oath of secrecy, I confided in the boy called Nissa, who sat next to me at school. I told him that my parents had sold me to Schumann's circus, and I was soon to be taken away from home and school to be trained as an acrobat, together with Esmeralda, who was considered the most beautiful woman in the world. The next day, my fantasy was revealed and desecrated. My class teacher considered the matter so serious that she wrote an agitated letter to my mother. There was a dreadful court scene. I was put up against the wall, humiliated and disgraced, at home as well as at school. 50 years later, I asked Mother if she remembered my sale to the circus. Did no one question the deeper reasons why a 7-year-old wished to leave home and be sold to a circus? Mother replied that they had already been troubled on several occasions by my lies and fantasies. In her anguish, she had consulted the pediatrician. He had emphasized how important it was for a child to learn at an early stage to differentiate between fantasy and reality. As they were now faced with an insolent and flagrant lie, it had to be punished accordingly. I had my revenge on my former friend by taking my brother's sheath knife and chasing him around the school playground. When a teacher threw herself between us, I tried to kill her. I was removed from school and severely beaten. Then my false friend caught polio and died, which pleased me. But I still fantasized about Esmeralda, our adventures becoming more and more dangerous, and our love more and more passionate. So much is packed into this one incident, the desperate importance of finding an actual place, the circus, where the two realms, magic and reality, combine. The first encounter with Anima, the white woman on the black horse, and the manic madness of falling in love. The romantic vision is outside of time, so Ingmar's age is irrelevant to the eternality of the archetypal emotion. The life and death risk that one might kill or die for one's vision. The disciplinary countermeasures of the real world of teachers, doctors, parents, the value of the secret, and the cosmic catastrophe of betrayal, which splits apart fantasy and reality, heaven and earth, Esmeralda and Porridge. Although the entire event blazes with importance and bears traces of Bergman's character and calling, there is no glimpse of future career, no message. There is no teleology, no determinism, no finalism. The second tale, more evidently connected to Bergman's calling, is about moving pictures. More than anything else, I longed for a cinematograph. The year before, I had been to the cinema for the first time and seen a film about a horse. I think it was called Black Beauty. To me, it was the beginning. I was overcome with a fever that has never left me. The silent shadows turned their pale faces towards me and spoke in inaudible voices to my most secret feelings. 60 years have gone by and nothing has changed. The fever is the same. Come the following Christmas, all the food was laid out and the distribution of Christmas gifts took place at the dining room table. The baskets were carried in. Father officiated with a cigar and a glass of sweet liqueur. The presents were handed out. That was when the cinematograph affair occurred. My brother was the one who got it. At once I began to howl. I was ticked off and disappeared under the table, where I raged on and was told to be quiet immediately. I rushed off to the nursery, swearing and cursing, considered running away, then finally fell asleep, exhausted by grief. Later in the evening, I woke up. Among my brother's other Christmas presents on the white, gate-legged table was the cinematograph, with its crooked chimney, its beautifully shaped brass lens, and its rack for the film loops. I made a swift decision. I woke my brother and proposed a deal. I offered him my 100 tin soldiers in exchange for the cinematograph. As Dag possessed a huge army and was always involved in war games with his friends, an agreement was made to the satisfaction of both parties. The cinematograph was mine. The apparatus also included a square purple box which contained some glass slides and a sepia-colored film strip, 35 millimeter. Information on the lid stated that the film was called Mrs. Hola. Who this Mrs. Hola was, no one knew. But later it turned out that she was a popular equivalent of the goddess of love in Mediterranean countries. The next morning I retreated into the spacious wardrobe in the nursery, placed the cinematograph on a sugar crate, lit the paraffin lamp, and directed the beam of light onto the whitewashed wall. A picture of a meadow appeared on the wall. Asleep in the meadow was a young woman, apparently wearing national costume. Then I turned the handle. It is impossible to describe this. I can't find words to express my excitement. But at any time, I can recall the smell of the hot metal, the scent of mothballs and dust in the wardrobe, the feel of the crank against my hand. I can see the trembling rectangle on the wall. I turned the handle and the girl woke up, sat up, slowly got up, stretched her arms out, swung round and disappeared to the right. If I went on turning, she would again lie there, then make exactly the same movements all over again. She was moving. Bergman's story of the movie machine makes clearer the difference between causality, being pushed from behind by the past, and teleology, being pulled toward a goal. To the question of why that little boy so desperately wanted the cinematograph, why he was willing to yield a whole army for it, causality replies, he had seen one previously and it piqued his curiosity. When his brother received it, sibling rivalry going back to earlier years and birth order provoked envy. Earlier still is the black horse of the circus incident, repeating his first remembered film, Black Beauty, which offers liberation, being sold as a passive form of running away to the circus, from the morally oppressive house of his father, the pastor. Or he may have desired power over his mother, over woman, whom he could make move merely by cranking the handle. Causality, or what classical philosophy, Aristotle, named efficient causality, tries to answer the question, what initiated emotion? By working back through a series of hypothetical connections, a chain of supposedly linked events, each presumed to have been initiated by the one preceding, even if all these links were actually connected, one pushing the next like a fantastical Rube Goldberg machine, the very first link is fastened to a bare surmise. Why that particular image of a black horse? Why ravishing Esmeralda? Why the circus? To what is that first spontaneous and long-remembered passion linked? Our answer? Ask Fate. Fate gives this reply. Ingmar Bergman, filmmaker in Acorn, at age 7, if not earlier, had his vision. He did not know it, could not foretell it, but something, daimonic, selected the events that made Esmeralda so compelling, and the later cinematograph so necessary. Fate had no teleological plan, no final goal of through a glass darkly, or the magic flute in mind. Yet the daimon's fateful vision infuses particular events with emotional importance. Thrill, feverish excitement, cursing. Bergman's fate was not sealed, but signified. Once more, let me try to distinguish the narrower idea of telos from the broad category of teleology, mainly because the first is most useful, while the second is usually not. The idea of telos gives value to what happens by regarding each occurrence as having purpose. What happens is for the sake of something. It has intention. Little boy Ingmar did not just concoct lies. His stories intended toward a lifestyle and career in which the lying stories not only made sense, but were necessary to the illusions of his kind of work. He was already making theater of his life before he had a stage or a script. To look at the events of his childhood through the lens of purpose changes them from mere lies and temper tantrums and obsessive desires to expressions of the necessities of his soul. Telos gives events value. But adding an ology to telos declares what that value is. It says what is intended by the tantrum and the obsession. It dares to pronounce the purpose. Such predictions are presumptuous because Bergman's lying could also belong to the pattern of a forger, of a huckster. The black horse could have carried him off in many directions. Esmeralda, Mrs. Hola, and the moving cinematograph image and the grass might have indicated painting or pimping, fashion design or cross-dressing. To state the purpose as if a definite teleological end was pulling him toward it, you are intended to be in the theater. Women will be crucial. Fantasy is your métier, and you must have control. This is presumptuous. It is also laming. For if you already know what the purpose of a symptom is, you've robbed the symptom of its own peculiar intentions. You have lost respect for its own purpose and thus lessened its value. Freud's theoretical system could state full well what was going on in a childhood obsession. But Freud said practice required withholding, abstention, reserve. He did not allow the practice of psychoanalysis to become teleological, even though he regarded all the phenomena going on in the analysis to have a telos. The Acorn acts less as a personal guide with a sure, long-term direction than as a moving style, an inner dynamic that gives the feeling of purpose to occasions. You get the feeling of importance. This supposedly trivial moment is significant, while this supposedly major event doesn't matter that much. Let's say the Acorn is more concerned with the soul aspect of events, more alive to what's good for it than to what you believe is good for you. This helps explain why Socrates' daimon told him not to escape imprisonment and execution. His death belonged to the integrity of his image, to his innate form. A death, whether in the bullring, on the toilet, or in a car crash, may make more sense to the image and its trajectory than to you and your plan. Accidents. The easy part is following the trajectory with dedication. We often feel what we must do. The image in the heart can lay down strong demands, and it asks us to keep faith. The hard job is making sense of accidents, those trivial gusts that take you off course and seem to be delaying your projected arrival in the teleological harbor. Are they hindering gusts, distractions? Or has each one its particular purpose? Do they together combine to advance the boat, maybe to a different port? You will not be able to find any point in an untoward incident if your compass is pointed too fixedly on the far horizon, and your teleological vision knows where you should be going, what you should be doing to get there, and where you are right now. Even more, what matters is not so much whether an interference has or does not have purpose. Rather, it is important to look with a purposive eye, seeking value in the unexpected. The purposive eye starts from the assumption that events can indeed be accidents. The world is run as much by folly as by wisdom, as much by order as by chaos. But, and this but is huge, these accidents may still intend something interesting. It is as fatalistic and teleological to claim cosmic design as to claim cosmic randomness. The eye of purpose merely looks into each accident, as these events are called, for what it says about itself. The soul seeks to fit it into its form. Betty Davis, 7 or 8 years old and away at school, was playing Santa Claus. Real candles lit a tree, and under the tree were all the presents. As little Betty tried to get close to the presents, she touched a candle with her sleeve. It spread through her costume to her cotton beard. Suddenly, I was on fire. I started screaming in terror. I heard voices, felt myself being wrapped in a rug. When the rug was taken off, I decided to keep my eyes closed. Ever the actress. I would make believe I was blind. Her eyes! A shudder of delight went through me. I was in complete command of the moment. The acorn had not staged the fire, but Betty Davis could indeed turn it into theater. A person's innate form incorporates the accidents. Character is fate. Consider the early years of two great connoisseurs of food. Pierre Frenet, in a Burgundy village, caught fish by slipping a hand over a resting trout and plucking it straight from the stream, then ate the fish, poached lukewarm with herb mayonnaise. He raised rabbits and killed chickens. He searched the early morning fields for little molehills which covered and whitened dandelion stems, improving their sweetness. In short, he grew up on intimate terms with the food we ate. Such raw incidents happened to any boy in that village, but Frenet's image turns them into the cooked sophistication of the professional chef. James Beard, cook, advisor to cooks, writer on cooking, gourmet extraordinaire, weighed 14 pounds at birth. He was an oversized accident for a mother in her 40s. Beard's natal body seems to have been chosen by his soul to incorporate fully the tastes and smells that were to be his kind of life. His first accident was also the scene of my first gastronomical adventure. I was on all fours. I crawled into the vegetable bin, settled on a giant onion, and ate it, skin and all. It must have marked me for life. Frenet and Beard, instances of the daimon making use of haphazard occasions. At 18, Churchill cracked his skull and ruptured a kidney in an accident while playing heroic battle games. During his convalescence, he found himself intellectually. The form not only integrates the fall, but is fed by it. While away at school, the elder brother of James Barry cracked his skull on the skating pond and died. Barry's mother went into years of seclusion and invalidism, mourning the loss of her favorite boy. Jamie, then only 6 or 7, kept his mother company in the sick room, trying to make her laugh. They told each other stories, hers biographical, his more invented. The acorn shaped the accident. The sorrow and the confinement, according to the image of J.M. Barry, writer of fantasy. The accident that blinded James Thurber in one eye, and eventually the other, his brother shot him with an arrow, while he was still a small boy, neither set his life course, nor blew him off it. The form bends to accommodate and finds purpose, like his early writing skills, like the amateurish quality of Thurber's outsized cartoons, drawn with odd scale and perspective. President Richard M. Nixon was especially fond of Tom Sawyer. It is hardly unusual to come upon that book in accounts of American boyhood reading, and Nixon was an avid reader and writer very early. Nixon liked the episode where Tom tricks Ben Rogers into whitewashing his fence, so much so that he learned it all by heart. Nearly 50 years later, in the White House, Nixon recited the episode without a mistake. Incidental trivia from childhood given significance by the soul. The great fashion designer Coco Chanel, who in 1924 invented the basic little black dress, passed all of her teen years in a rigid monastic orphanage. It was an imprisonment, and every trace of it, and her time there, has been erased from the records, as well as from her memoirs. "Don't tell me what I'm feeling. You can die more than once in your life, you know," she once said. But the classic austerity of her suits, their symmetrical perfection, her constant use of black and white and gray, replicate the accidents of her suppression, despite her effacement of the memories. What the soul needs, it uses. It is amazing how practically wise it can be about misfortune and accidents. Wisdom in Greek was Sophia, as in our word, philosophy, love of wisdom. Sophia had a most practical meaning, referring originally to the crafts of handling things, especially to the helmsman who steers the boat. The wise one steers well. The wisdom of the helmsman shows in the art of making minor adjustments in accord with accidents of water, wind, and weight. The daimon teaches this wisdom by constant appraisals of events that seem to pull you off course. This is also philosophy. The love of making little corrections, little integrations of what seems not to fit in. Sometimes this attention to the singular event is called by philosophers saving the phenomenon from the metaphysical trajectories of theories. These accidental movements neither hinder nor advance the main project. Rather, they reshape its form, as if the course and the boat itself were being restructured by the soul's responses to the events of life. There is a craft of growing down. It's the wisdom of watching things with an eye to their effects. This idea of continual moving adjustments is nothing new or strange. As far back as Aristotle, the soul was conceived to be both the form and the motion of a body. The form is given with beginnings as the image of your lot, and it shifts as we move. This form, for which we are using many interchangeable terms, image, daimon, calling, angel, heart, acorn, soul, pattern, character, stays true to form. Some accidents swamp the boat, bust the form. For example, shell shock, as post-traumatic stress disorder was called during the First World War, rape at knife point, crashes at high speed, repetitive, abusive cruelty. Some souls nonetheless seem to work with it. Others remain fixated in the tar, struggling to work it out, as we see in the recurring nightmares of Vietnam veterans. Has the acorn been so damaged by these accidents that its form remains incurably injured, a gestalt that cannot close, a rudder broken no matter how the helmsman steers? Fatalism answers, everything is in the hands of the gods. Teleological finalism says, it all has a hidden purpose and belongs to your growth. Heroism says, integrate those shadows or slay them. Put disaster behind you and get on with your life. In each of these replies, the accidental as category dissolves into the larger philosophy of fatalism, finalism, and heroism. I would rather keep accident as an authentic category of existence, forcing speculations about existence. A serious accident demands answers. What does it mean? Why did it happen? What does it want? Continuing reappraisals are part of the aftershock. The accident may never be integrated, but it may strengthen the integrity of the soul's form by adding to it perplexity, sensitivity, vulnerability, and scar tissue. Developmental theory regards the accidents of Churchill and Chanel, of Thurber and Berry, as representing typical youthful trauma, which may be sublimated, transformed, and integrated through time. Time heals all wounds. The acorn theory says that Churchill's fall, Thurber's lost eye, Barry's mother's mourning and Chanel's monastic adolescence belong appropriately to their acorns. These accidents in youth were not foretold by the acorn as if laid down in a divine plan, nor were these untoward events determinants of later career, forcing it forward along a defined path. Rather, they were necessary accidents, necessary and accidental, both. They were means for the soul's calling to come forth, ways the acorn expresses its form and form their lives. In Churchill's case, it took a sudden shock and slow convalescence. In Barry's and Chanel's, a long imprisonment. Inside the orphanage, Chanel was learning the discipline, as Barry was learning by telling stories to his sick mother, as Richard Nixon's inner form picked up precisely the tale he needed from Tom Sawyer's capacity to con. Necessity. There remains one last biggie, the one Plato put right in the middle of his myth. Necessity, she who turns the spindle on which are wound the threads of our lives. Remember the tale. The goddess, Ananke, or Necessity, sits on her throne amid the fates, her daughters, companions, and aides. But it is she, Ananke, who establishes what the soul has selected for its lot to be necessary, not an accident, not good or bad, not foreknown or guaranteed, simply necessary. What we live is necessary to be lived. Necessary to whom? To what? To her, goddess Necessity. Necessary because necessary? Hardly an answer. We have to speculate. Who and what is Ananke? First, she is extremely potent among the powers of the cosmos. Plato cites only two great cosmic forces, reason, nous, or mind, and necessity, Ananke. Reason accounts for what we can understand, for what follows reason's laws and patterns. Necessity operates as a variable, sometimes translated as erratic, errant, or wandering, cause. When something doesn't fit, seems odd or strange, breaks the usual pattern, then more likely necessity has a hand in it. Though she determines the lot you live, her ways of influencing are irrational. That is why it is so difficult to understand life, even one's own life. Your soul's lot comes from the irrational principle. The law it follows is necessity, which wanders erratically. Little wonder that we readers are drawn to biographies and autobiographies, for they offer glimpses of how irrational necessity works in a human life. Although necessity's rule is absolute and irreversible, this determinism is indeterminate, unpredictable. We have already encountered this idea of irrational causes in several previous chapters. The genetic explanations that rely on chaos theory, chapter 6, the kids who wander off the beaten track to read the strange and weird fantasies of Pulp Fiction and Penny Dreadfuls, Chapter 7. The something else breaking into intentions, as when Ella Fitzgerald suddenly sang, though her reason for going on stage was to dance, and Barbara McClintock forgot her own name. And we have seen the erratic cause at work in the many school refusals and expulsions, and in mentors' sudden perceptions of the beauty and potentialities of their pupils. Chapter 5. In fact, we have been following the wandering trail of necessity all through these pages, watching how she operates and feeling her inexplicable and undeniable power. Ancient images make visible this undeniable power, and ancient roots of the word Ananke demonstrate it further. Ananke derives from a root that spreads through old Egyptian, Akkadian, Chaldean, and Hebrew terms for narrow, throat, strangle, constrict, and the yokes and rings laid on the necks of captives. Ananke takes you by the throat, holds you prisoner, and drives you like a slave. Mythological images and pathological problems refer to each other. Jung's famous dictum makes this explicit. The gods have become diseases. Nowhere does the god in the disease show more strongly and tersely than in the tightening heart pain of angina and the anxiety states that hold you back from free action. Both angina and anxiety derive from ananki. The point is that there is no escape from necessity. It will not yield, cannot submit. Ne plus kedere. Kant defined necessity's German equivalent, Notwendigkeit, to mean that which could not be otherwise. This makes the understanding of our lives remarkably easy. Whatever we are, we could not have been otherwise. There is no regret, no wrong path, no true mistake. The eye of necessity reveals what we do to be only what could have been. What might have been is an abstraction, remaining a perpetual possibility, only in a world of speculation. What might have been and what has been point to one end, which is always present. T.S. Eliot. As we perform an act, make a choice, we believe there are options. Options, personal agency, choices, decisions. These are the catchwords ego thrives on. But if we look up from the engagement for a moment and speculate, necessity's implacable smile says that whatever choice you make is exactly the one required by necessity. It could not be otherwise. At the moment the decision falls, it is necessary. Before it is decided, all lies open. For this strange reason, necessity guarantees only risk. All is at risk in each decision, even though what is finally decided upon at once becomes necessary. By claiming that necessity has laid its hand on each of the decisive moments of my life, I can justify whatever I do. It appears as if I can slip the harness of responsibility. It's all in the cards. Or the stars. Yet this unyielding dominatrix of a goddess makes me quaver over each decision, for there is no predictability in her errant irrationality. Only in hindsight can I find certitude, saying it was all necessary. How curious that life can be foreordained, yet not foretold. Then where are the errors? How can one go wrong, and why feel guilty? If all that happens is necessary, what about remorse? Since necessity incorporates whatever decision I make as necessary, then necessity must be imagined as an inclusive principle that adjusts the image of each life to include all its actions one by one, whatever they may be. We are still collared, but the collar is adjustable. Necessity's yoke produces that feeling that we are always somewhere caught, somehow a victim of circumstances, longing for liberation. I may know that what had to be, yet nonetheless I feel remorse. Necessity says the remorse too is necessary as a feeling and belongs to your yoke, but it does not refer to what you actually might or should have done otherwise. To understand necessity in this way makes mistakes tragic, rather than sins to be repented or accidents to be remedied. Things cannot be, could not have been otherwise. Inexorably, everything belongs, fatal flaws and all. And the course of necessity plays out until the bull's horn finds your gut. It takes a large heart to accept the tight collar. Most times we reject the odd, irrational events that come down on us. Most times we try to ignore disturbances, until the heart calls our attention to them as possibly important, possibly necessary. The mind is the last faculty to submit, and there is usually a tug of war between the heart's calling and the mind's plan, a conflict within each human replicating Plato's two principles of nous and ananke, reason and unreasonable necessity. Sure, the mind can postpone the call, suppress, and sell out. You will not therefore necessarily be punished and damned. The daimon is not necessarily a pursuing demon, a Christian hound of heaven. Revenge is not one of necessity's daughters. Necessity, in fact, refers only to that which could not be otherwise, or that which you could not escape. Escape is not a sin, because necessity is not a moralist. Escape can belong just as well to your soul's lot and its pattern, as can facing the music and taking the arrow